Well, I am delighted and honored to be here. And since I plan on speaking more on history than on theology, I thought I should wear a bright tie so that when you get sleepy, you can glance at the tie and be aroused. I was encouraged to wear this by Lanny Lambert and his choice in ties. So I thought if he can get away with his, I can get away with this one, maybe. Well, we've had a series of books, How the Irish Saved Civilization, How the Scots Invented the Modern World. What have the Welsh ever done? I'm going to write How the Dutch Saved True Theology. You all know I don't have a drop of Dutch blood, but I was converted amongst the Dutch and have spent my time since then studying a great deal about Dutch history and Dutch theology and appreciating the Dutch and living among the Dutch. And so in certain ways, I self-identify as Dutch. Well, had I been here 2 years ago, I would have given a very, very different address to you. Sinclair and I had talked a little bit. It's interesting to talk to Sinclair. He's never forthcoming. So I still wasn't sure what he was going to do, but I thought I would do something on worship, on how important it is in the 21st century to maintain a genuinely reformed view of worship. But in the years that have intervened, we've gone through a lot in this country, haven't we? Maybe not in South Carolina. Maybe you're buffered from all these things. But we've been through pandemic. We've been through bitter political controversy. And a year or two ago, I began to reflect that many of the people I was talking to confessed to a kind of confusion, finding it difficult to connect with the world in which they found themselves living. All of a sudden, they were saying they felt kind of like aliens in their own country. Things just seemed to have changed. And of course, at my age, you're tempted to think, well, you're just getting old and grumpy, you know. But people expressed a great sense of confusion and sometimes a real sense of anger. I don't get this world. And that led me to do some thinking, as a historian about what is going on in our country, in our time, in our world. Because in order to defend the Reformed faith, and I can hardly think of a better summary of the Reformed faith than the one we just received. What it is we want to defend? All right, one better one, the Heidelberg Catechism. But aside from that, that was so splendid and thoughtful and balanced and right on. And that makes it all the easier, in a sense, for me to do what I want to try to do. We'll see how successful it is. Because Sinclair has really told us what we want to defend, what we need to defend, what is God's truth that we will defend. But I want to talk about where in history we are doing that defense. Where have we come to? Why do we feel somewhat strange and alienated and out of sorts and angry and anxious? Now, if you all tell me that you don't feel that way at all, I'll go on and talk about worship. But I really think this is the world we're increasingly living in. And I, as I thought about it, trying to think about it as a historian, concluded, and it's always dangerous to date things too precisely, But I think our world changed in America in a most dramatic way in 2015. In 2015, the Supreme Court of the United States declared gay marriage a right. That's sort of intriguing when you think about it. In the whole history of mankind, at least as I've read, not once in the history of mankind had there been a state or civilization or religion that had legalized gay marriage. The first time in human history, apparently, when gay marriage was legalized, I have to say to my shame, was in the Netherlands in the year 2000. So mankind had lived for millennia without gay marriage. And now suddenly it's a fundamental human right recognized by the United States Supreme Court. Now, I am not arguing that our world changed with that decision of the Supreme Court. I'm arguing that our world changed as we survey the reaction to that decision. I read a pundit sometime afterward who wrote that a number of his friends had commented, wasn't it amazing that there was a county clerk in Kansas who refused to issue a marriage license and went to jail? And this pundit wrote, I'm amazed that only one refused to issue it. And that got me thinking. What does it say about our society that there was so little reaction to that decision? And my belief is, and I'll try to develop this and maybe convince you, or maybe just annoy you, my conviction is this marks in a profound way the end of Christendom. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with the term Christendom. It's a term used a lot by historians looking at the history of Western society. Christendom refers to a civilization in which certain Christian values and beliefs are embedded in law and in the dominant culture. And Christendom has dominated the West for over 1,500 years. That's a long time. That's older than Dr. Ferguson. 1,500 years, think of it. Christians initially, you know, were persecuted by the Roman government. And then the Emperor Constantine in the early 4th century gave to Christians some rights and protections and toleration. But by the end of the 4th century, around 380, the Emperor Theodosius of happy memory, you all do remember the Emperor Theodosius, the Emperor Theodosius declared that Christianity was the one true religion and would be the only legal religion in the Roman Empire. And from that time on, in various ways, Christianity was protected in law by Western governments. And there emerged a consensus in society about certain beliefs and moral values. Now, the idea that the West became Christendom is not at all to say that all of the West were Christians. Not at all. But it meant that the worldview, the framework of values and outlook, the fallback position was in some broad sense Christian. So in times of distress, we would talk about our need for God and for prayer. In facing the grave, we would talk about the reality of heaven and hell. In thinking about moral values, we would talk about the importance of the family. In much of Christendom, divorce became extremely difficult. And even the people who were not honoring the Christian code of values and were not in any heartfelt way believing Christian truth still had that as the kind of framework that they acknowledged and lived with. I've just been reading a really quite fascinating book called Last Call at the Hotel Imperial about American foreign correspondents in the 1920s and 30s who began to report on what was going on in Europe in those dramatic days. And one of the most important ones was a woman called Dorothy Thompson. And Dorothy Thompson led what we would call an irregular life. She was a little like Elizabeth Taylor. You remember Elizabeth Taylor when being challenged at getting married 8 times said, "It shows how much I believe in marriage." As she began to see more and more of the real character of the rising Nazi movement in Germany, she wrote passionately, "We need the response of Christian civilization to Nazism." Well, that was an appeal to Christendom. That was a sense that Christendom provided certain values, the value of the individual, human dignity, the toleration of other religions like the Jews. She was appalled at what was happening and appealed to Christendom as a way of processing the reaction to National Socialism. That was the way Westerners had thought. That was their fallback position for centuries. When President Obama ran for re-election in 2012, I think it was South Carolina that put him over the top, was it? It's a joke. Come on, don't be nervous. When President Obama ran for re-election, he declared repeatedly that he was opposed to gay marriage. Why did he do that? Well, I don't want to read his heart, but I think he still believed that Christendom existed and that the moral consensus in America in 2012 required that he be opposed to gay marriage to be reelected. And yet in just 3 years, that apparent moral consensus of Christendom had collapsed. And the reason that we feel so confused and so anxious and so angry, it's not entirely clear what's going to replace it. Now, it's not surprising that Christendom should collapse and that I'm the only one who's noticed, which makes me a little nervous. But the truth is, part of the way of seeing the movement of Western history in the last 3 centuries is a movement of sustained attack on Christendom. And one might argue that what's amazing is that Christendom survived as long as it did in light of this sustained attack. First came the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, a determination to refocus Western society on issues of freedom and political justice. Now, many of the things the Enlightenment thinkers had to say were true. Many of the political injustices that they attacked needed to be attacked. But that the notion that the way to bring about a new world was to cut off the heads of as many aristocrats as they could, and to get rid of a 7-day week and introduce a rational 10-day week, one of the many ways in which the French Revolution tried to fundamentally change human life and experience, was an attack on Christendom. And then in the 19th century, that attack began to be energized in a number of different directions. And you'll be thankful to know we can't go into too much detail about this. But if we think about three of the leading intellectual figures of the 19th century, we can see how that attack begins to come from a number of different directions, always in the name of freedom, always in the name of a better world, and always in the name of science. Now, I don't want anything I say to be interpreted as an attack on science. Science is great. We need science. But part of the attack on Christendom is that Christendom is anti-science. Christendom is old-fashioned. Christendom is passé. And that we need to get with it, with this modern scientific way of thinking. And in this modern scientific way of thinking, sometimes, that is modern scientific way of thinking, sometimes explicitly and sometimes only implicitly, what was always assumed is God either does not exist or is irrelevant to the enterprise of creating the new world we envision. The new free world, the new scientific world, the new rational world. And that even if God does exist, he surely does not speak. And so in the 18th, 19th, 20th century, one of the essential elements of the attack on Christendom was an attack on the Bible. The veracity of the Bible, the reliability of the Bible, the usefulness of the Bible, the clarity of the Bible. But the three great figures of the 19th century that sort of exemplify what was coming was, first of all, Darwin, who with his theory of evolution articulated powerfully the notion that we are not creatures of God, we are not created in the image of God, but we are evolved from animals. What is interesting to me as a Christian is the strong resistance of many of the champions of the new world and the new way of thinking to really facing the implications of what they're saying. If God is irrelevant, if we're animals, if we live only for this life, what does that imply? Doesn't imply anything about love, does it? Doesn't imply anything about kindness? Doesn't imply anything about community? It doesn't imply anything about respect for human rights. And so we have had discussions of what was called social Darwinism. If we're all just animals, why shouldn't the strongest among us dominate? Why should the strongest have any care for the weakest? And where there was any call for regard for the weaker, where there was any call to love, I don't think it's too much to say those are leftover, inadequately observed or appreciated remnants of Christendom. They are not inherent in the movement. One could easily argue that Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party were the fulfillment, the logical fulfillment. I'm not saying Darwin was out for this, but was the logical fulfillment implicit in the notion that human beings are just animals and that there ought to be the survival of the fittest? Where does racism come from? It comes from a notion that in the evolution of mankind, some races are superior to others, and some races have the right to rule others. Some races have the right to use others. Now, Christians have not always opposed racism as they ought. We should acknowledge that and be ashamed by it. But racism does not really arise from Christianity or from Christendom. It arises from notions about the nature of mankind that are inimical to Christianity. And when Adolf Hitler argued that the Aryan race was superior, I remember when I was young talking to a couple of Germans who had been raised in pious Lutheran households and then become part of the Hitler Youth. And they later became Lutheran ministers. But they said to me, you know, as young people, Nazism seemed the wave of the future. Nazism seemed modern and scientific. They were the ones who understood the new science. They were exerting their force. And with what tragic consequences? Since we are the stronger race, the Jews should die. Since we are the stronger race, the Slavs should die and get out of our way. There's a terrible book called Bloodlands, which is about the suffering of the Ukrainians for the last century. First Stalin killed them, and then the Nazis came and killed them, and now the Russians are coming again to kill them. The fact that these folk have any resilience as a people is absolutely amazing. Millions and millions of them died. A lot of them from starvation. In the name of two modern scientific ideologies. Nazism on the one hand and Soviet communism on the other. Because the second figure we would talk about and think about in the 19th century is Karl Marx. And Karl Marx said, all of history, all of human thinking is driven by economics. All of history is class warfare. All of history is driven by the oppressed and the oppressors. There is no God, but there is a movement of history that ensures one day the triumph of communism and a new world order in which all will be equal and all will be just. Really? How can you have that confidence if there is no God to oversee the movement of history? Once again, I think we can see in Marxism little unexamined remnants of Christendom. Marx had a kind of millennial vision of a future with no real foundation for that sort of hope. And so Lenin and Stalin tried to create that reality in the Soviet Union. That everything was driven by economics. Now, there's a kind of irony here that we'll see as we move along. So which is it? Is it economics that determines everything? Or is it evolution that determines everything? Evolution that impacts not only race, but also sex and gender. It's an evolutionary product that we have males and females. What is the proper relationship between males and females? Well, there's been a lot of injustice in human history about relations between males and females, hasn't there? What is the strongest influence in certainly Western history, maybe I could dare say in human history, to defend women and their dignity and their rights? It's Christianity. If we have a survival of the fittest, why shouldn't the men browbeat the women? That's not what Christianity has ever said. The husband is to love the wife. So you begin to see various streams in the developing attack on Christendom, each stream emphasizing a different concern, the concern of race, the concern of sex and gender, the concern of economics. And then, of course, we have the third figure, and I know I'm simplifying everything way out of proportion and very broad brush. If Sinclair was broad brush, I don't know what mine would be, you know, maybe a crop dusting. The third figure is Freud. Now, what's interesting is, to me, Darwin and Marx are thinking about mankind as a whole, mankind as a group. They are relatively little interested in the individual. You know, Stalin's famous statement, the death of an individual is a tragedy, the death of a million is a statistic. Communism never cared about the individual. That's why there's so little communist resistance to Stalin's purges, when heroic leaders of the communist movement from early days were taken out and just shot. They gave their lives for the party. They were martyrs for the faith. Freud comes along and talks about the importance of the individual. Talks about the need to really know who we are internally. What drives us? What makes us? What shapes us? If we're animals, we may not have any real nature that God has given us. But we've developed according to certain experiences and patterns. And of course, one of the parts of the good news was you can blame your parents for most things. That's a good thing. All my strangeness is the fault of my parents, who probably above all else entirely failed to instruct me adequately and properly about sex. Can you say that word here? I like to joke and say the only subject talked less about than money in my parents' house was sex. My wife and I say that our fathers used to leave the room if anyone said breast of chicken. So it'd be easy to blame them, be able to put all the burden on them. So Freud says, who are we? How are we shaped? How do we get over all the mess that others have made of us? And of course, the amazing thing is that soon we find There are the people who think Freud is absolutely right, and then his disciple Jung says, oh no, he's not right. There's a whole other approach to this. And then there are the followers of Jung, and then there's Adler, his followers who break with Freud, and then there's Steckel, who studied with Freud and broke with him. The other day in California, I know you people love reports from California. Makes you feel so much better. The other day, the superintendent of public instruction in California announced that in the response to all of the difficulties the schools had been facing, that the state of California would pay to hire 10,000 school counselors. 50 years ago, someone might have said, maybe what we need is school chaplains. But no one said, what kind of counseling, from what sort of perspective, are these 10,000 counselors going to counsel? You see, increasingly, we have lived in a new world where the problems and the solutions are viewed in radically different ways than was ever the case in Christendom. And so, as we heard earlier, in 1918 with the Spanish flu, the city, the state, the country were called to prayer. No one has called us to prayer in this pandemic. You may have called us to prayer, but no public official that I've heard, and that's maybe just because I live in the People's Republic of California, has called us to prayer. Because with the end of Christendom, the dominant values of our society have ceased to be the values that would look to a God, the values that would expect a heaven or hell, the values that would talk about us being created in the image of God with certain responsibilities. That family is an institution of God that we must advance. Anything transcendent is gone in the world without Christendom. And increasingly, Christians are being treated not simply as benighted. You know, when I was in college, we got the tap on the head. Oh, isn't that nice that you believe that stuff? With the implication, what kind of idiot are you to believe that stuff? Did make me think when Pastor Ferguson was speaking of a college experience I had in college relative to the free offer of the gospel, where a guy I knew fairly well was being spoken to by a very well-meaning evangelical Christian on campus, and the Christian said, God loves you. And I went to a college with fairly smart people, and so this pagan responded, well, then I'm in perfect shape, aren't I? Well, no, wait a minute, you just told me God loved me. Are you going to tell me now he doesn't really love me? We had some students from seminary who understand what it is to be Calvinist. They went to the local junior college. They set up a table with books and tracts and put a big sign in front of the table that said, God may not love you. Brought over quite a number of people who were curious. Well, if we live in a world where Christendom has ended, it won't just be that Christians are seen as somewhat pathetic or irrelevant or passé. Increasingly, we'll be seen as dangerous. And it's already started, hasn't it? If you criticize gay marriage, you are guilty of hate speech. Now, wait a minute. I thought We had free speech in this country. Oh, we have free speech, but we don't have hate speech. One of the few advantages of being really, really old is I can remember back to the student riots in the Vietnam War days at the University of California in Berkeley, which styled itself a free speech movement, that it could speak out boldly against the war in Vietnam. And then when it became more and more vulgar in its criticism of the war, they renamed themselves the Dirty Speech Movement. And that was very much the rhetorical way in which they tried to get attention. And when Christians would say, this language is offensive to me, they immediately said, oh, I'm really sorry, we'll change. No, they didn't say that. You Southerners really are gullible. They said, we have a right to talk this way. You have no right to criticize us. They didn't know anything about microaggressions. Thank you, whoever. But it's very interesting. We now have become dangerous because we might offend the psyches of people if we dissent from the new consensus that gay marriage is good, that homosexuality is good, that transgender is good. And if you criticize any of those things, you reveal yourself to be a bigot and intolerant and hateful. And as a society that is utterly dedicated to love, we can't tolerate that. It is always true that the ultra-tolerant become intolerant. And that's why I thought this was an important lecture to at least try. Because we're increasingly going to be living in a world where we don't have any kind of fallback cultural support for the things we say. Have you noticed that when people die, we have celebrations of life? Not that that's a bad phrase, but often it's entirely horizontal. There's very little reflection. And where there is reflection on maybe some continuation of life after death, it's, yes, so-and-so became an angel. Does that grate on you as a theologian? This talk of human beings after dying becoming angels? And I often wonder, what do they think of angels being? I don't know. I'm grumpy about everything. But think of that poor Christian baker in Denver who didn't want to make a wedding cake for a gay marriage. Now, I'd have been interested to listen to the argument if he'd been the only baker for 100 miles. But there were plenty of other bakers this gay couple could have gone to. They wanted a confrontation. They wanted this guy put out of business or in jail. And I think what you see in the gradual collapse of Christendom over the centuries is that part of what facilitated that collapse of Christendom is that Christians, when they listened to complaints about racism, said, yeah, we've been guilty of that. Some of that complaining is absolutely right. And when they heard about sexual relations and identities, Christians said, you know, there's some truth to that. When they were pressed on the issue of homosexuality, Christians said, you know, maybe we haven't been as understanding and tried to minister to homosexuals in their need the way we ought to. When Marxists talk about economic inequalities, I think Christians said, you know, we do need to care for the poor. That is an obligation laid upon us by the scriptures. And so Christians have been willing to look at the Christian past and say, yeah, there's sin in our past. What else would you expect? The whole message of Christianity is that we're sinners in need of salvation. The best of us, with the exception of Jesus, in the history of Christianity, have been sinners. Desperate sinners. Sinners who in themselves could have no hope in the mercy of God. That includes preachers, as well as the rest of you. But when we concede our failures, as we should, then that can be used to hit us about the head. The calling on us as Christians, it seems to me, is to decide what are we going to do when we're hit about the head. My own conviction is Christendom is not coming back. And I don't know what's coming, because what we see in the world around us now amongst us, what will I call them, is a bunch of secularists, those who are dedicated to this world, dedicated to the various sciences of this world. What I see is no real consensus or vision emerging. Some are so concerned with race, it's the only thing they see. Some are so concerned with gender relations, it's the only thing they see. Some are so concerned with gender identity, it's the only thing they see. Some are so concerned with economics, it's the only thing they see. And these people, when they were attacking Christendom, could be united. But if I'm right and they've defeated Christendom, they will likely all fall to fighting with one another. You see that perhaps to some extent today in the Democratic Party, where various factions are at it with one another. I don't mean to be complimenting the Republicans, who by and large are just slower and dumber. I try to be an equal opportunity annoyer. How are we going to live as Christians? How are we going to promote the Reformed faith that was so eloquently summarized for us? Well, I think implicit and probably explicit in what Sinclair said to us is the most important response that we will have is in building and preserving sound churches. The church as the family of God will be the light shining in a dark place where people who may come to disillusionment with the program of remaking this world in the image of animals will want again to hear about a creator and about the image of God in humans and about a redeemer. So the church has always been God's great instrument of redemption. It was the church that challenged and then changed the Roman world. And there have been some wonderful studies of what was crucial to the changing of Rome from a pagan empire to a Christian empire. And it was precisely, again, I'm way oversimplifying, but it's still precisely the case that it was the loving life of Christians that eventually made such an impact on the conscience of those Romans. Conscience is a gift from God. Conscience cannot be destroyed by the foolishness of man. And so the love that Christians showed, taking infants who'd been left out on mountainsides to starve to death into their homes and caring for them. Christians staying in cities that were plagued, that were seeing plagues in the city, and the healthy abandoning the sick, and Christians going in and caring for the sick. The protection that Christians gave to women was another testimony in the ancient world. There's a great story when the Reformed Church was spreading in France about a family that had joined the Reformed Church in the city of Lyon. And the elders summoned the father of the family to a consistory meeting and said to him, "Your wife has complained that you beat her." And he said, "Yeah, I've always beat her. What's the big deal?" And the elder said, "The big deal is that you're supposed to be now a Reformed Christian, and that's not allowed in our families and in our churches. You're not to beat her anymore." Lyon eventually went back to the Roman Catholic Church. I don't know if that one incident, you know, Reform stories are never like Pentecostal stories. Reform stories hardly ever have happy endings. But there was the testimony. There is a standard in God's word to which we can appeal against the foolishness of human sinners. And in this world, that's what the church preeminently needs to be and to foster, if we're to be the light in the world that Christ has called us to be. And I think that means significantly when they beat us about the head, we have to respond the way the Savior did. We have to be willing to suffer. We have to try not to be angry. We have to be more concerned to defend Christianity than to defend the remnants of Christendom. When we're angry, we're probably thinking, in the good old days of Christendom, this wouldn't have happened to us. And it's very understandable to react that way. But I don't think that's the reaction that will advance the cause of Christ. The cause of Christ will be advanced where we are willing to bear the abuse that Christ bore. So the church must become the great focus of the life of Christians. But I'd like to suggest there is a secondary, and it's quite secondary, goal that we need to start thinking about, because I think many American Christians have really not thought about this. And that is, how do we raise a Christian voice that insists we are here and we want to be heard? And my model, at least for this, Are you waiting? Is a Dutchman. Abraham Kuyper was born in the middle of the 19th century. He was the son of a minister in the State Reformed Church. He grew up as a very, very bright student, got a doctoral degree at an early age, and became a minister in the Hervormde Kerk. And discovered during his first pastorate in a little village that he wasn't really converted. He learned this because there were a group of malcontents in the village that he'd been warned about. The people in the church said, "Oh, those people hardly ever come to church, and they're always complaining, and they're so difficult. Just ignore them." But Kuyper was an idealistic young pastor, and so he went to visit with these people, And they said to Kuiper, well, we nourish our spiritual life on the old writers, the Oude Schrijver. Write that down in your notes. Shoot. It's better in Dutch. The old writers. Oh, said Kuiper, who are the old writers? The great Dutch theologians of the past. Those are the ones we read. Oh, said Kuiper, who is that? Well, the great Dutch theologians, John Owen, William Perkins, and they listed off largely English Puritans who had been translated into Dutch, and these common folk who were not well educated did not know enough history to know that these weren't Dutchmen. Because, of course, they assumed all good sense came from Dutchmen. And Kuiper was so impressed by the piety of these people and began to read some of what they were reading that he was converted. And then became a very powerful minister and writer for a time, and then left the ministry to go into politics. This was profoundly shocking to the pious reform folk of the Netherlands. To leave the ministry was like leaving your wife. It was really unthinkable. And it was clearly a step down. If you could be minister to a Dutch Reformed congregation, why would you want to be prime minister of the country? That's the way they thought. And of course, we're right. But Kuiper felt the calling of God to serve in politics, and he rejuvenated a tiny little political party called the Anti-Revolutionary Party. It was the party organized to stand against the spirit of the French Revolution. And Kuiper almost prophetically wrote of the coming challenge of totalitarianism in the West and the destruction of a Christian civilization. And warned Christians to think about this. And part of why he was drawn to politics was he wanted to try to develop a Christian voice in politics. Now, in Holland, with a parliamentary system, you could have a party that could gain seats. In America, it's much more difficult with a two-party system. But there ought to be a Christian caucus of some sort that would begin to articulate, what are we after? What would we like to see happen? And I don't think most of us as Christians have given any thought to this at all. Do we want to go back to the 1950s and anyone caught in a homosexual act being sent to prison? Do we want to go back to the 1960s when the American Psychiatric Association said homosexuality was a mental disorder? Do we want to go back to the days when homosexuals were beaten up on the streets? What do we want? What are we after? Do we want homosexual marriage repealed? Should that be a political goal? I don't have the answer to all these questions, but I don't think we're even thinking about them. We're not talking about them. What would we like to see happen? When the revival comes and we change the American Constitution and Sinclair Ferguson can be president, what do we want him to do? See, I don't think we're thinking, how do we live in this new world where Christendom has ended? What the secularists are saying to us, you have no right to invoke God in the public square. And what we as Christians have to say is, we have every right to invoke God in the public square. That's what freedom of religion is all about in this country. And not only do we have the right to invoke God in the public square, but we have the right to invoke His Word. But then when we're pressed, all right, what is the program you want? Well, we want to have biblical values in law. Do you want to make anger illegal? That's a biblical value. We could all be in prison together. You see, part of the task of politics is a task of prioritizing what we're after. Kuyper set as his primary goal there in the later 19th century to get government funding of Christian schools. That was his number one goal. And he eventually got it. It took decades, but he eventually got it. What would be your number one goal if suddenly Christian influence could accomplish something in Congress? Or to put it another way, if Congress finally could accomplish anything at all. If we're going to be a voice of love and concern and reason and biblical truth, not just in our churches where we can proclaim the whole counsel of God, but in the public arena of America today, we need to give a lot more thought as Christians. What are we after? What are our priorities? Part of what was so magnificent about Dr. Ferguson, I hate to praise him in public, but what was so magnificent is the way in which he was so wonderfully able to prioritize elements of Reformed theology in a way that explained everything else. Now, Reformed theology has been around for about five centuries, so he's had time to work on that. But I think the time is short for us to articulate a public voice that says, you know, you may have gained control of the universities, and you may have gained control of the arts, and you may have gained control of the media, and that includes Fox News. Fox News is exactly the same. There's very little Christian voice on Fox News. You may have gained control of the entertainment world, but we're still here and will not be silent. We don't want to speak in anger. We don't want to speak out of hate. But we think the path you are pursuing is leading our civilization to destruction. And at least in California, one of the places to see that most clearly is in the public schools, where all sorts of social engineering is going on. And the good news is the kids can't read, so they can't read this stuff. What are schools for? Not for social engineering, but for teaching basic skills like reading, writing, and arithmetic. We need to be a voice for that in our world. I think if we're going to defend the Reformed faith, and I think we must defend the Reformed faith, and we've been given this brilliant summary of the Reformed faith, we need to know what the world is like in which we need to defend it. And it's a cowardly new world. I was going to say brave new world. It's not a brave new world. It's a cowardly new world. And I think if we raise our voices, we're going to see these cowards are going to suddenly be like, this is surely mixing metaphors, like the emperor's new clothes. They will be revealed as not having any real agenda that makes any sense to most people. I had an experience of a post-Christendom world when I was 19. I had the privilege of studying for about 9 months in Germany. It was 1964. As a 19-year-old, I thought the World War had been over forever, but the Germans I met, of course, thought the war was a recent phenomenon. And one of the trips we took was to Berlin, to a Berlin in which the Berlin Wall had only a few months ago been constructed. And so the whole character of the city had changed. There were these terrible walls and barbed wire, no man's land, and monuments to people who had been shot trying to cross the no man's land. And one Sunday morning, some fellow students and I decided we would go into East Berlin to church. And we crossed at Checkpoint Charlie. You go to Berlin today and there's a museum about Checkpoint Charlie. It makes me feel very old. But I actually went through Checkpoint Charlie. We walked this narrow walkway into East Berlin. And such a contrast with West Berlin, still many just open areas of formerly bombed out buildings. The East German government had was in the midst of a major campaign to try to get people reading. And so there were all these kiosks with posters on them with the German word read, which struck us as very ironic because the German word for read looks like the English word lies. And so we thought, wow, this government's more open, honest than we thought, admitting that everything it's saying is lies. Well, we got to this big downtown old Lutheran church that had not been destroyed in the war. And we went in, and the congregation was small and by and large very elderly, except for the secret police sitting in the back. And this relatively young, it seemed to me, minister came to the pulpit to preach. And very interestingly, and I thought very courageously, raised the question, so how are we to live in this world in which we find ourselves as Christians? And he said, as Christians, really we have three possibilities. We can become revolutionaries and take up arms against a government of which we do not approve. He said, I do not think that is the Christian answer. He said, secondly, we can become just resigned that this is life and it'll never be any different and we can have no hope. It's all futile. He said, that's not the Christian answer either. He said, as Christians, we have to live with patience and with hope. It was remarkable. It was insightful. I'll be accused again of being a Lutheran by quoting a Lutheran. But he was right on, I thought. When you live in the post-Christian world, don't be angry. Don't be confused. Don't get lured into revolution. Don't give up. Don't despair. But live with patience and with hope. Because, you know, Jesus is coming again to make all things new. And before he comes again, he will gather all his elect. Not one will be lost. And it doesn't matter what they do or what they say or how they treat us. All the elect will be gathered. We ought to try to have a voice of truth and light and love in this world. But above all, we need to be a church that brings redemption to those who are drawn by the Spirit of God. And we should remember, in the words of Psalm 47, "For God is the King of all the earth." Sing praises with a psalm. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne. No revolution will touch him there, and he will accomplish his purpose. Let's pray together. O Lord our God, how thankful we are to know that we serve a sovereign God and a saving God, and that whether we live in times of great success and influence for the church or times of great retreat and loss, you are sovereign, you are king, you are accomplishing your purpose, and you do all things well. So help us not to lose heart. Help us not to be confused. Help us not to be angry. But help us in all circumstances to rely on you and to find in Jesus Christ our comfort and our strength. For we pray in his name. Amen.